Today at Reader's Corner, Blaine Harden, author of Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1836, two missionaries and their wives were among the first Americans to cross the Rockies by covered wagon on what would become the Oregon Trail. Dr. Marcus Whitman and Reverend Henry Spaulding were headed to present-day Washington State and Idaho, where they aimed to convert members of the Cayuse and Nez Perce tribes. Both would fail spectacularly as missionaries, but Spaulding would succeed as a propagandist, inventing a story that recast his friend as a hero and helped to fuel the massive westward migration that would eventually lead to the devastation of those they had purportedly set out to save. Blaine Harden is a contributor to The Economist, PBS Frontline, Foreign Policy, has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia and Africa, as well as a local and national correspondent for the New York Times and a writer for the Times Magazine. He is the author of four previous books, including the international bestseller, Escape from Camp 14. Blaine Harden, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to talk to you.
Well, Blaine, your career as a journalist and a writer has taken you across the globe with some very impressive credentials for writing books. And one of those books, as I mentioned, Escape from Camp 14, was an international bestseller. But this particular book seems to draw on your experience in Eastern Washington as a kid growing up. Could you just give us a flavor for what it was like in those days and how you learned about Marcus Whitman and Henry Spaulding?
Well, I grew up in Eastern Washington, in the town of Moses Lake, not too far from Walla Walla, where much of the book is set. And when I was in grade school, our class performed a play about Marcus Whitman. And, I don't remember too much about it, although I did finally get the script. I found the script of the play. But what I took away from that when I was a kid was that Marcus Whitman and his wife Narcissa were good Christian people who did their best to help the Indians, and the ungrateful Indians killed them. That was basically the message I took away from my class. And what's interesting about the play is that it was supported, sanctified, and distributed by the state of Washington. This was the official version of history that I was supposed to learn. This was in the early 1960s.
Wow. Well, you know, people often ask me, how do you find a book? How do you find an author? What decision process do you go through? In your book's case, it was really simple. I was at a bookstore one day. I saw the title. I read the subtitle. And then I read the jacket, and it said Walla Walla. And I thought, Walla Walla, I'm one of these Boise people that goes to Walla Walla for wine trips. And I've been in and out of Walla Walla a dozen times. I walked the campus of Whitman College. I stayed at the Marcus Whitman Hotel. And what I know about this story, you could put in a thimble. And so personally, I thank you for writing it because it gives me a whole new perspective on my next trip to Walla Walla. And it's just really an incredible story. And I suppose we should begin with the larger perspective of what was going on out east in America at that time that connected Protestant evangelism with this nationalist fervor that even brought these guys out here.
Well, what was going on was the most numerous flowering of religiosity in American history. Around the end of the 1800 and 1790, very few Americans went to church every Sunday. By 1830s, which is when the Whitmans got in a wagon train and came west with the Spauldings, nearly everybody went to church. 80-90% of Americans were going to church every Sunday. And it was a evangelical brand of Protestantism that had seen the largest growth. And the Whitmans and the Spauldings were part of that sect. They were Calvinist Protestants who believed in a very strict brand of religion. You had to do a lot. You had to jump through a lot of hoops to find salvation if you're a Calvinist Protestant. So they came west in 1836 to convert the tribal people before other whites arrived. And one of the reasons they went was, it was a noble reason, is that they had seen what Andrew Jackson was doing in the South with the Cherokee, the Choctaw, and the Cree, which was genocide, taking away land that had been promised to them and sending them west to Indian country, now Oklahoma. And along the way, many thousands of them died. It was a terrible thing that was much regretted in the Northeast. And so the Whitmans, sponsored by the American Board of Foreign Missionaries, were sent out to prepare these Indians in the Pacific Northwest for the coming horde of white people. It was hoped that if they learned to be Christians, learned how to read, they would be able to fit into what was going to be a white-dominated society.
So tell us about these tribes, who they were, their numbers, the acreage they commanded in their day as these whites approached.
Well, let's talk about two tribes. We'll talk about the Cayuse. The Cayuse is a small tribe, several hundred people, at most 1,000, but really around 600-700. But their power and influence in the Columbia Plateau was much greater than their numbers would suggest. They were the first adopters in the Pacific Northwest of horses. And they had thousands and thousands of horses, which they sold and traded and rode. And they were raiders. They were slavers. They were traders. They really were sort of the monarchs of this region. And they had a key ally in the Nez Perce, which was the largest tribe on the Columbia Plateau, by far the most powerful militarily, culturally. In fact, the Cayuse adopted the Nez Perce language. By the time the missionaries arrived, most of the Cayuse were speaking the Nez Perce language. And the reason the Cayuse and the Nez Perce wanted white missionaries and a white god to come into their world is because they thought it might give them a spiritual edge in competition with other tribes. And the difference between spiritual and material edge was not really a significant difference in the minds of a lot of these tribal people. They really associated the natural and the spiritual world. They were very, very interconnected. So what had happened before the white god came along with the white missionaries was that white culture, in terms of horses, guns, blankets, wool blankets, cooking pots, steel knives, all these things had added to the material wealth and power of the Cayuse and Nez Perce. And so they thought the missionaries and the white god would be a similarly helpful supplement. That's why they welcomed them and gave them a nice piece of property to live on temporarily while they preached about the white god.
So let's talk about these two missionaries. We'll start with Marcus Whitman. Let's first of all talk about what he actually did as opposed to the Whitman lie that was propagated by Henry Spaulding. But tell us, what did he and his wife do in Walla Walla over these years?
Okay, they arrived in 1836. They were killed in 1847. So they were there for 11 years. And they were singularly unsuccessful in converting the Cayuse to Protestantism. The records show that they converted two people in 11 years. And during that time, Narcissa lost her only child, who drowned, a little girl, which broke her heart and set her on a path of depression. And she turned away from the Cayuse, who she'd come to save. So she ended up being a teacher and kind of a mother to orphan children who arrived on the increasing number of wagon trains that came from the east to the Oregon country. And she, by the time of her death, she had very little to do with the Cayuse. Similarly, Marcus Whitman had stopped really trying to convert anybody and was much more in the business of selling and giving food to new white arrivals on the wagon trains. He'd become somewhat of a real estate developer, and he had said as much in a letter. He said that the Indians have failed to be fruitful and multiply, but by golly, the whites certainly are, and so that's where I'm going to focus my efforts. And that is basically his story. He was a medical doctor as well as a missionary. And he had been warned that it's very dangerous to be a medical doctor among the Cayuse because they have a long tradition of killing medicine men who fail to heal the sick. And about the time of the killing of he and his wife and 11 other white people, there was a measles epidemic that had devastated the Cayuse. They blamed Dr. Whitman and had warned him to get out of there because if he didn't leave, they were going to kill him. But he stayed. And they were true to their word, and they killed him and his wife.
You're listening to Blaine Harden. He's the author of Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. Now, somewhere in the book, you point out that this white conquest of the West that was inhabited by these Native Americans started unfolding for the tribes in a very difficult fashion. As these settlers arrived, there were just all kinds of injustices that morphed into tribal activity, the likes of which wind up as the Whitman killing. So I want you to talk about the Whitman killing, the massacre as it's called, but please put it in the context of what I think it was Anton Minthorn told you about this particular moment in history for the Cayuse, that, yeah, there was a massacre, but historians didn't really spend as much time talking about what happened that played such a critical role in this massacre occurring.
It was probably one of the most predictable and predicted Indian killings ever. When the Whitmans and the Spauldings arrived, they were told by the head of the Hudson's Bay Company, which was the British trading outfit that had been there 20, 30 years before the Americans arrived. And the chief factor of the Hudson's Bay Company, a guy named Dr. John McLaughlin, who was a Canadian and really a great man. He actually welcomed the American missionaries, fed them, traded with them. And he said, you know, you have to be careful working among the tribes on the east side of the Cascades. They're much more warlike. And if you fail as a medicine man, as I just said, they will kill you. And so they were warned a decade before the killing that they were under some threat. But what happened was the missionaries were incredibly ethnocentric. They looked only at their own religion and their own culture and basically ignored what the Indians were telling them. And each year, as the Whitmans settled in and established quite a prosperous mission there with lots of wheat and cattle and other grains and fruits, and they welcomed these increasingly large wagon trains that arrived every fall from Missouri. It started out with 25 wagons would arrive, then 100, then 400, then 600, then 1,000, and 4, 5, 6 people on each wagon. And the Cayuse and the Nez Perce and the other tribes on the Columbia Plateau, with each arrival, they started to realize that soon they're going to be outnumbered on their own land, which caused incredible anxiety. That and then the diseases. Politicians in Oregon would later write that the settlement of the Pacific Northwest was really great for white people because white people diseases killed all the Indians, so you didn't have to kill them yourself. It was a very easy conquest compared to the fighting that would occur in the Great Plains a little later on in the 19th century. So all of these things had riled up the Indians and made them anxious, fearful. They perceived an existential threat accurately. But one of the things that's important to understand is that Marcus Whitman was responsible for two important historical events in American history. One was true and one was completely phony. The true one is that when he was killed, along with his wife and 11 other white people, that killing was a pivot point in American history. News of the killing found its way back to Washington within about 9 months, and it persuaded the president and Congress to make the Oregon Country, which would turn into Oregon, Washington, and Idaho eventually, to make it an official territory of the United States. Previously, it had been held in a vague joint ownership treaty with the British. So once the killing occurred, the Pacific Northwest became a part of the United States and soon became three states. So that's what Marcus Whitman and his wife did. And they didn't do it with any particular achievement. They did it by getting killed. So that's the true part of the story. But most of my book, and the reason I wrote the book is because of the false part of the story. And I haven't talked yet about the Reverend Henry Spaulding. The Reverend Henry Spaulding is sort of the dark hero of this book. He came west and while harboring a terrible grudge against both of the Whitmans, and that came out of his thwarted love for Narcissa. He fell in love with her when they were both at the equivalent of junior college when they came from upstate New York. He proposed to her when he was in his 20s and she was a little bit younger, and she rejected him. She rejected him for a host of reasons, but mostly I think it was because of the difference in their class and income. She was from a prominent family. She was an attractive woman with a beautiful singing voice. Her dad was a prominent guy, and Spaulding was the opposite. He was the bastard child who grew up in a series of homes, some of which the father of the house would throw him out. But he did become religious in his late teens, so he proposed to her, and she just said, "No way, am I marrying you?" And Spaulding never forgot it and never forgave her. In one of the great ironies of American missionary history is that Narcissa ended up marrying the good doctor, Whitman. He became a missionary working for the American Board in Boston, but so did Spaulding. Spaulding would later marry a missionary woman named Eliza, who actually turned out to be the best missionary of the lot. But all four of them traveled together in the same wagon train, just a couple wagons, to the Oregon country in 1836, and they shared the same tent. And the Whitmans were on their honeymoon, and Spaulding he listened in on their honeymoon. And there is very strong evidence that he was in the tent on the night she conceived her only child. So Spaulding's, his resentment, his disappointment, and his mental health, which was never that great, it must have suffered a severe test on that trip out west. Years later, before she was killed, Narcissa wrote in a letter to her father that we should never have come west with Henry Spaulding because of his anger and his spite has really soured our lives.
Well, let's talk about the legacy of lies, Blaine. And I wonder if you could share with us then just where this story goes from here, thanks to Henry Spaulding, who oftentimes inflated the truth, to put it mildly. What happens to the Whitman story, especially the part about the winter march to Washington?
So Whitman did take a trip to Washington and to the East Coast in 1842, which is 6 years after he arrived and 5 years before he was killed. But he went east back to Boston by way of Washington in order to persuade the American Board of Missionaries not to cancel their missionary business in Oregon. The missionaries had been squabbling and fighting among themselves, with Henry Spaulding being one of the main squabblers. And the American board had heard about it and ordered them all to come home or to leave the mission near Walla Walla. And when Whitman heard about this, he jumped on a horse and rode east in 1842 to change the board's mind. On his way, he stopped off in Washington, where he may have had a discussion with members of the administration of President John Tyler. It's not clear exactly what he did in Washington. There are no records that he talked to anybody important other than he possibly talked to the Secretary of War. Anyway, he did go to Boston. He changed their mind, and he got an extension of their missionary duties, and then he went back to Oregon. So that's what really happened. And then in 1847, he was killed along with his wife. But after the killing, Henry Spaulding decided to make up a much grander story about what Whitman had done on that trip. In fact, he waited 20 years before he really completely hatched this story. And his story, as he told it, and it was a complete bag of lies, but it's important because it would become the official history of the Pacific Northwest for about 40 years. So he made up this story, and his story was that Whitman had seen that the British and the Catholics and the Indians were conspiring together to steal Oregon, all of Oregon's, the beautiful land of Oregon, for the British. And so when Whitman heard this story, according to Spalding's big lie, he got on his horse and rode to the White House, burst into the White House and told the president of the United States that the British were coming and the Catholics and the Indians were collaborating with them to steal this precious part of America. And he persuaded John Tyler not to allow this to happen. The president didn't allow it to happen. And then Whitman led this triumphant, huge wagon train back to Oregon and saved Oregon. So this is a story that Spalding made up. And then he made his own journey back to Washington in 1871 with what he called his manifesto, which was a grab bag of exaggerations and nonsense, several hundred pages of testimony from various people who were basically repeating Spalding's lie. And he persuaded the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives to print everything that he had claimed. And once this was printed in an official government document that was then circulated to universities around the East Coast, this became the primary document, the source for a new and completely false history of the United States that became official. And it was in virtually every history book taught to virtually every kid, high school student, college student in the country. It was in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It was in the New York Times repeatedly. And virtually every other newspaper in the country used this story, often describing Whitman's trip back east as more noble, more exciting, more wonderful than Paul Revere's ride. So this lie then held up for about 40 years.
You're listening to Blaine Harden. He's the author of Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. And I might add that the University of Washington history professor even got in on the act. I think you quote Edmund Stephen Meany, who talked about the brutality of the killings. And while I mention the killings, I do want to give our listeners a couple of visuals. Tell us about the day the Indians were hung for those killings. Who showed up? How many?
Well, a very significant percentage of all the white people in the Oregon country came to Oregon City in 1850 for this hanging. And this was after the first full-scale sort of proper murder trial in the territory. It was proper in all the trappings, but basically it was a foregone conclusion that whites demanded justice, vengeance, actually, for the killings of the Whitmans and the 11 others. And so five Cayuse, who may or may not have been involved in the actual killing, some of them probably were, at least one almost certainly wasn't. In any case, the law enforcement built a gallows big enough to hang five people at the same time. And they did. They hanged them with one cut of a rope. And then they were buried in graves that the whites later lost. And the Cayuse have never been able to locate where these Cayuse five were buried. And that is something that really sticks in the craw of the Cayuse people who now live on the Umatilla Reservation.
Now, there's a new breed of scientific historians you talk about in your book that set the record straight, or attempt to anyway. Tell us what happens later.
So what happened is that in 1900, a professor at Yale who had been tipped off by a graduate student from the University of Washington who had sensed that Whitman College was using the Whitman Saved Oregon story in order to raise money, which is true. That's a major part of the book. He went back to Yale to study. And he turned over all his notes to Professor Edward Gaylord Bourne, who was a prominent historian at Yale, a full professor, somebody who always looked at primary documents, primary sources, letters, contemporaneous coverage in the press, contemporaneous statements by people involved. And he didn't really accept the story that Grandpa told about what happened. And so he looked at the record and he found more than 4,000 letters, more than a million words, actually, that were at the American Board Library in Boston, American Board of Foreign Missionaries. And he read the letters, and it was clear that Spalding had made most of this up. There was a smattering of truth, but much of it was a crock of baloney. And so Bourne was an eminent historian. He was highly thought of in the American Association of History in the United States. And at the annual meeting of the American Historical Society, he presented this devastating paper that said that the Whitman Saved Oregon story was a myth. just like a Greek myth or a story from, you know, from Europe that was just totally nonsense. And soon, especially on the East Coast, Marcus Whitman lost his luster. He had been one of the most respected and well-known explorers in American history, even outranked Meriwether Lewis for a decade or two, according to polling that was done by New York University. But so he faded from the American mind after Bourne denounced him. And then he got all the coverage in the East Coast papers. But what's really interesting about the Whitman story is that it persisted in the Pacific Northwest. And I think there's an analogy. It's analogous to what happened in the American South. Regions of the United States like their history, simple, action-packed, ordained by God, and a history that makes people feel proud to live where they live. In the South, after the Civil War, whites invented a new version of what that war was all about. They claimed that it was about states' rights, the principal defense of states' rights under the Constitution, rather than about the forced slavery of human beings. And to celebrate this noble war, they put up statues of Confederate generals in virtually every city and small town across the South. This all happened in the early part of the 20th century. In the Pacific Northwest, after the story of Whitman was completely debunked, and it was clear that Whitman was not a great hero, he was a mediocre missionary, we here in the Pacific Northwest decided to have our own reality. We decided that Whitman was in fact still a hero, facts notwithstanding. Statues of Whitman were forged in the 1950s. This is 50 years after the Whitman story was debunked. And the state legislature in Washington state decided that Whitman was the most valuable human being who'd ever lived in the state. And they sent his statue back to the Hall of Statuary in Washington, D.C. as the greatest Washington state resident who ever lived. And they did it in spite of the evidence. And I think it says something about the stories that Americans cling to feel good about themselves. And what's interesting to note is just last month, the state legislature decided they'd made a mistake and they're removing the Whitman statue and replacing him with Billy Franks Jr., who is a member of a tribe in the west coast of Washington state who had fought for fishing rights all his life.
Could you bring us into the future as far as these tribes are concerned? The work of Charles Luce in helping get self-rule for the tribes, and how today they've managed to put together a very sustainable culture and livelihood, economy. I pass the Wild Horse Casino all the time on my way to Walla Walla. Yeah. Help us with that.
This sordid story has a great ending, one that really makes me happy as an American, because what happened with the Cayuse and the other tribes that live on the Umatilla Reservation, which is in Northeast Oregon, there's the Walla Walla and the Umatilla share the reservation with the Cayuse. What happened was they had about 150 years of torment and being cheated and having their land taken and being derided as bad people who killed the Whitmans. But what happened in really beginning in the 1960s, but and it's gone on up to the present day, is that with the Indians returning from having served in World War II, they came home and they wanted the rights that all Americans should have. They wanted their rights under the law. And to summarize it briefly, is they managed to find lawyers. First, they found white lawyers. Charles Luce, who represented the tribe, was the first lawyer that ever represented them, who helped them win some monetary settlements from the federal government. Then they began to train their own lawyers, their own land use development planners, their own biologists. And they used federal law, state law, and some executive decisions that came out of the White House from Richard Nixon, of all people, to empower themselves. And the big stroke of economic power came from the 1994 Indian Gaming Act, which allowed them to build that casino that you drive past on your way to Walla Walla. And the tribes have used the money from that casino, which turned out to be a lot more than they expected, to invest in ancillary businesses, including office parks, retail, some agriculture development, road building. And they have turned the tribe around economically, sociologically. They have a lot more people getting good educations, and there are a lot more people who want to live on the reservation now. And so they've really emerged as an economic and political powerhouse in Northeast Oregon. And that's how my book ends. I talk about elders of the tribe. Anton Midtorn is someone you mentioned. He's one of the elders, but he has another elder whose name is also Midtorn. They like to go to the casino, have a sandwich, have a Sprite, and watch white people lose money.
A fitting conclusion to a dreadful part of American history, but as you say, a good ending. Blaine Harden, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner. The name of the book, Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. What a great read. Thanks, Blaine. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.